afternoon, I'd like to reflect a little bit more upon this theme of awakening and one of the ways that it's spoken about. The Buddha once said that just as the great oceans only have one taste, which is the taste of salt, so too does this path and this teaching only have one taste, which is the taste of freedom. And that is a taste that pervades the entirety of the path, from the most gentle surfaces, the small acts of kindness, of care, of generosity, of ethics, to the unfathomable depths of transformation of heart and mind that can be experienced directly in this path. So this afternoon, just to reflect a little bit on that taste of freedom and how it is really expressed in the context and in the framework of the Satipatthana Sutta that I referred to this morning, the teaching on the ways of establishing mindfulness. Now, the teaching begins with the words that this path and this practice really only has one direction, and it only has one outcome, which is freedom, the unshakable liberation of the heart. But we need to give a little bit of history, I think, to that statement. When Siddhartha took his seat under the Bodhi tree, it clearly was not the beginning of his story and not the beginning of his journey. Just as we do, he very much brought the story of his life and the understandings that had been born of that story to his seat. And it was clear that Siddhartha had learned certain lessons from his life. Living his life in India at that time, as we understand it, a life of some privilege, also a life of some indulgence in sensory gratification, a life where, certainly by the standards of that time, he probably had far more security and position and role and status than many. But the lessons that Siddhartha had learned from that life was that all that he hadn't actually delivered. All that he hadn't actually brought him the enduring peace or happiness or protection or safety that he had longed for. And what he saw so clearly, that all that he had gained, all that he'd been given, all that he had accumulated did not protect him from the rhythms of life of which he was part. The rhythms of birth, of sickness, of uncertainty, of aging, and of death. He also brought to his seat under the Bodhi tree some of the understandings that had been born of his reaction to that life of privilege and materialism and indulgence. As an ascetic, he lived a life of self-denial, of avoidance, of self-mortification, and even sense of self-abuse. And he'd learned from that life that this was also not the way to find an enduring happiness or peace or freedom. I think both sides of this spectrum, these lessons equally, have really brought about what we come to understand as a middle path. These were the lessons he brought to the Bodhi tree, to find a path between the extremes of indulgence and rejection. The middle path between the extremes of craving and aversion. He'd learned something about the importance of inclusivity, of instead of trying to transcend the world, to actually find in himself the willingness to turn towards his life as the ground of awakening. He'd also brought to his seat under the Bodhi tree some important lessons about generosity and of kindness. The story, as we inherit it, tells of a time in the life of Siddhartha as an ascetic where he had been so abused and so undermined by his practices of self-mortification that he lay close to dying on a riverbank, and that it was the gift of food offered by a young woman that saved his life. And he'd learned something about that generosity, of the need not only for external generosity, but the kind of generosity that really needs to form a pillar in this path, the generosity of care. It brought to his mind another important lesson that he brought to the seat, his seat, about the integrity of metta, the integrity of kindness, of caring for his life, of not harming anything, including himself. There were certain, out of these insights, there were born, I think, certain attitudes of openness, of welcome, of inclusivity, of kindness, of integrity, all of the lessons that are said to be foundational in any path of deepening. Not optional extras, but as the very pillars, the very foundations of a path of awakening. Now, these insights, in many ways, really set the stage for his journey. They were turning points in his own mind, in attitudes, and in understandings. Now, like Siddhartha, our journey and our story doesn't begin the moment that we take our seat in formal meditation. We are probably here because there are lessons that we have all learned from our life experience. And some of the primary lessons that we've learned from our life experience are the lessons known and sometimes learned very painfully and sometimes very slowly. But lessons we have learned from our life about what it is that leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. What it is that leads to a peaceful heart and what it is that leads to agitation. We bring these to our seat. I actually find that many Westerners or many people who live in this culture come to meditation with a considerable amount of insight before they begin. In fact, much of what you hear in this practice, in this path, this is not news to you. It's not new, some new revelation. I think as people living in the life we live, the world that we live in, that we actually have a lot of encouragement to be somewhat inwardly aware and reflective, to garner from our lives certain understandings. And we've learned, probably, many of the same lessons as Siddhartha. Sometimes it's kind of astonishing how timeless human consciousness is. So too, it seems, are quite timeless some of the propensities that really lead to alienation and to difficulty. But most of us in our lives have probably learned the lesson by this time that aversion, rejection, resistance, to what is actually happening. Really doesn't do very much except to compound and to magnify difficulty and pain. We have probably all learned in so many ways through the example of others and through our own journeys the very deep and enduring value of kindness, of compassion, and of patience, qualities that are absolutely so essential if we're going to find in ourselves the courage and the fearlessness to meet the life as it is, with so many of its moments of joy, but so many moments of challenge and of difficulty. I am imagining that we've all learned the lesson that disconnection and fear and numbness really do very little except to make us feel more powerless and impotent in the face of life's realities, and actually disables our capacity to meet what our life asks us to meet. And certainly, one area that we are asked to meet with remarkable patience and kindness are some of the seemingly intractable and stubborn patterns of our own life and our own minds. I think we've probably learned the ways in which disconnection and numbness and dissociation really serves to disable our capacities for joy, for happiness, for appreciation, for sensitivity. And that endless sensory gratification really only offers temporary pleasure, but little enduring happiness. This doesn't mean that there's something wrong with sensory pleasure. It comes to us in our life. It's much delighted in, much appreciated. And this is not a path or a practice of somehow trying to close our eyes or our hearts to the loveliness that is also part of our lives. But I suspect that through many of the lessons that life has taught to us, that we too have found the encouragement to begin to develop a middle way, a middle ground, a middle path, a ground of calmness, in a way surrendering those inclinations towards extremes. The extreme of succumbing, feeling helpless, powerless, and the other extreme of overcoming, trying to suppress, trying to control. This middle ground probably is our very first taste of freedom. Now, the Satipatthana Sutta really begins with the encouragement to take our seat in the forest, at the roots of a tree, in an empty hut. These are metaphors. Somebody got a phone going somewhere? Oh, it might be in the cloak. These are metaphors. It's important to understand that they're metaphors. They're not instructions, you know, to go off and find your nearest forest or your nearest empty hut, you know, and that's a prerequisite for practicing. But they are metaphors. They're an encouragement to take our seat in some solitude, inner solitude. Not disconnection. Not dissociation. But I'm sure we're probably all aware of how the degree to which solitude is becoming an endangered species in our culture. There's a new pathology. Some of you may have come across it. FOMO. Do you know it? Fear of missing out. And fear of missing out means that we can never actually take the time to be alone because we might miss out. And yet we really actually see how much in this pathway solitude is really regarded as a refuge. It's regarded as an ally. It's regarded as a sanctuary. The capacity to be alone with ourselves and not to lean. The capacity to find a way of resourcing ourselves inwardly rather than to live in perpetual dependency. Perpetual sense of need or lack. It's the wisdom of solitude. These phrases are also metaphors for taking our seat in mindfulness, to collect and gather ourselves from the busyness of our lives, but more from the busyness of our own minds. It's not an encouragement to flee from the world, but to treasure awakening and to really actually know, no matter how much we may be surrounded by people who love us, by people who care for us deeply, this is a journey we actually do walk for ourselves. This is a path we do develop inwardly that really can't be gifted to us by someone else. And actually, I actually really feel that that capacity to be able to sit quietly with ourselves and to find some contentment and some happiness and some peace within that is already a taste of freedom. Because it's about taking our seat in a quality of uprightness, a gesture of freedom. It's almost like a statement of confidence in our own capacity for awakening. We live, I think, in a time in our world that can be so fraught with a sense of despair and a sense of powerlessness, the feeling that we are perhaps so small against the huge forces of a time and a world which seems so intent almost on self-destruction on so many levels. And yet this practice and this path has always taught us that we are actually never powerless. That it's so essential actually to have that confidence in our willingness and our capacity to meet ourselves in our lives and to make a difference. There is something very profound that happens in the moments when we actually stop running and stop fleeing or stop just checking out, because there is so much encouragement for us to do that. And I think it's no surprise that the Buddha really did speak about this path as swimming against the tide. And in that sense, it's almost countercultural. You know, you don't hear many messages in your day. This is a good time to pause. This is a good moment to collect yourself. This is a good moment to reach out. Instead, we have so many messages to abandon. To abandon and to find some kind of really illusory refuge in abandonment. Whether it's refuge, an illusory refuge in fantasy, or whether it's a refuge in sensory gratification, or whether it's a refuge in becoming. And it's not to say that there's something wrong with living a dynamic and engaged and a fulfilled life, but to actually sense that this is somehow a way of escaping from our own being is probably incorrect. Certainly I've discovered, as I'm sure you've discovered for yourselves, that you know, this body, this mind, this heart is, this is a marriage for life. There are no divorces here. There are no divorces here. And there is something about feeling that confidence and that treasuring of the quality of this heart and mind that is our ongoing companion. Returning home, this is a frequently used metaphor in this teaching. homecoming, coming home to ourselves. It's a taste of freedom in really finding the willingness to let go of all of the agitation and fear that's involved in so many efforts to avoid and to flee from the difficult and from life. And it's so deeply important to acknowledge that taste of freedom in that willingness to turn towards rather than to turn away from. It's probably a taste of joy. You see it in the many of the kind of statues of the Buddha where he has this gesture of reaching out to touch the ground. And it was a gesture that arose from that night under the Bodhi tree when Siddhartha was assailed by all the voices that said, you can't do this, you're not good enough for this, this is impossible for you. And the story as we inherited, but Siddhartha did just reach out to touch the ground and said, the earth is truly my witness to my capacity for awakening and the genuine possibility of this awakening. I think taking our seat in solitude is always also a shift in understanding about what freedom actually means. Because this has become a very elastic word, hasn't it, in our time? Freedom usually means license. It means permission. You know, we talk about, we sort of reify, you know, in certain cultures, free speech, which usually means the freedom or the permission to dump whatever delusion or hatred upon the world through my speech that I wish to. But that's free speech. We have a very elastic, often, definition of freedom. We often see it as a license to pursue our cravings, a license to pursue aversion, that this is a gesture of freedom. I saw this very clearly one time when I was in the States, and someone was outside in the parking lot at the center kicking the cars. And you know, things happen in meditation centers. They're sometimes inexplicable. But somebody asked him what on earth he was doing. And he says, well, it's a free country. This is not actually freedom, is it? It is the imprisonment of our own impulses. And what kind of freedom is that? To feel imprisoned by our own compulsions and to define that as a kind of freedom. When the Buddha speaks about freedom or liberation in this teaching, it's actually really simple because he actually talks about the unshakable freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion. The profound inner autonomy and unshakable peace and wisdom and compassion, the freedom actually of not being governed by anything. And there's a curious paradox, I think, in this exploration of this explanation of freedom, because it seems actually to know that unshakable inner freedom, we're almost asked to restrict the freedom of our impulses. We're almost asked to practice some restraint around the compulsions of our cravings and aversions that may previously have defined our sense of freedom. So we take our seat, really just as Siddhartha did, and we sit here, as you've probably experienced today, pretty much surrounded by our life that follows us onto the cushion, follows us onto our walking path. And we can almost see ourselves, you know, you can almost imagine yourself as kind of sitting in the center of a circle. surrounded by all those that you love, surrounded by all those that you struggle with, they've probably all made an appearance today. We see ourselves sitting in the middle of a circle of all of the adversities and difficulties that are present in our life today, the things we are preoccupied with. They've probably come to visit. We see ourselves sitting in the midst of all the joys of our life, the things we appreciate, the people we love and care for. We sit in the midst of our likes and our dislikes, our histories and our hopes. They are all here with us. And the taste of freedom, my own sense of this, really begins with our willingness and our ability to welcome all of this. Many of you will be familiar with that saying. It says the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Many people hear that statement and immediately think that they need to retire. I think it's a little bit of a stretch, actually. I think the great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to their preferences. This might be more workable. But actually, mindfulness does ask us to find that great way. To bring a receptive and interested awareness into this circle, to exclude nothing, to bring a calm and non-judgmental, a kind attentiveness to be with our world, because freedom, as the Buddha taught it, was not outside of this circle. It's in the middle of it. Reb Anderson once said that, you know, the Buddhas don't practice in the suburbs of suffering. They practice downtown, in the middle of this. We can begin to taste the freedom, actually, of not being governed by the attachment to our preferences. What it means to be unconditionally present actually is quite a big thing, because it means to surrender aversion. Means to give up a lot of fear and anxiety. It means the willingness to surrender our tendency to welcome only the pleasant, to give up, actually, our bondage to the pleasant, and to bring an unconditional mindfulness. First, we bring this unconditional mindfulness to the body, as the Satipatthana teaches it. And what is the freedom that we can begin to discover within the foundation of the body? Now, the Buddha described mindfulness of the body as a noble and divine way of practicing. He even went on to say that without mindfulness of the body, there is no mindfulness at all. We might say that the purpose of being mindful of the breath, for example, the body breathing, is to begin to taste the freedom of a stable, balanced, non-aversive, non-dwelling mind within mindfulness of breathing. I sometimes get so frustrated when people sort of interpret the instructions around mindfulness of breathing as somehow a concentration marathon. You know, that my practice is going to be measured by how many breaths I have in a row. No, our practice is measured by how much understanding we see within the mirror of mindfulness of breathing. We are here to develop a mind that is a friend, a mind that is an ally, a heart that is a friend and an ally. Through mindfulness of breathing established within the body, we're learning to free ourselves from the restless, agitated mind, so easily lost in past and future, in rehearsal, in speculation, in storytelling. The mind that is free of all of this is not a vacant mind. It's not a vacuum. It's not something that is bland or blank. But it is actually the mind of a deep acceptance, empathy, appreciation, sensitivity, capacity for creativity, capacity for articulation, capacity for communication. Now, the instructions in the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta are actually really very, very simple. Being mindful within the breathing, knowing the breath just as it is. Whether it's long or short, deep or shallow, rough or smooth, simply to know this. To begin to sense this cultivation of unification, of integration within the mindfulness of breathing, of body, mind, present moment. A sense of oneness within the breath, knowing its beginnings, knowing its endings. And breathing in, calming the formations. That's the instruction. Breathing in, calming the formations. Breathing out, calming the formations. Now, clearly the formations that were, it's a strange word, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the formations that we're intending or endeavoring to calm are the formations or the constructions of tension, of restlessness, of dullness, of anxiety, of agitation. In terms of insight, our relationship to our breathing in meditation is pretty much a microcosmic view of many of the relationships that we have in our lives. And that within mindfulness of breathing, used in that insightful way, we really do begin to get a sense of the ways in which suffering is born and the way in which struggle and suffering comes to an end moment to moment. The whole of the path actually could be said to be held within that first instruction. Breathing in, calming the formations. Breathing out, calming the formations. Now, we have a lot of ideas about how things should be, don't we? There's hardly an area of our life that is not touched by ideas of how it should be. And have you noticed how there's a very short slide from the idea of how things should be to the insistence that they are that way? How there's this kind of continuum sort of from wanting to needing to demanding to, and often it just gets magnified or encapsulated, sorry, in that word should. And we do it with the breathing too. I see so many people sort of get themselves into endless knots of trouble within mindfulness of breathing. You know, oh, I should have a long breath. My breath's not deep enough. You know, my breath's too shallow. You know, oh, where should I be with my breath? Oh, my breath is too jagged. You know, there's not enough breaths in a row. It's just, see, this total, and I think, well, this is probably not the first time this has happened in your life. Because think of how that expands through the rest of our life. It's so challenging for us to let go of that world of demand and insistence and to learn to align ourselves with the moment just as it is. I sometimes think the whole development of this path is learning to put down our argument with the unarguables, which again is not a prescription for passivity, but may actually be the beginning of wise effort. Learning to be with the simple truth of the breath is a profound lesson in learning to be with the simple truths of the moment in our life as they are. This is conflict. This is sadness. This is the breath as it is. This is craving. This is lovely, just as it is. Can we align ourselves? These are hard lessons. Because it's really that invitation to kind of relinquish that whole world of wanting and insistence. And we usually learn this the hard way, don't we? Usually learn the hard way because we see for ourselves the more that we actually hold on to those insistences and those demands and those imposed, rigid expectations is actually the degree to which we suffer. And probably we do come to see for ourselves that the gap between the way things actually are and the way we think they should be is for most of us an ocean of tears. So there's a deep freedom in releasing the shoulds, because it's also releasing the blame. Whether that blame is projected outwardly, it's your fault that my life is not the way it should be, or the blame is directed inwardly, it's my fault, my failing, that my life is not the life it should be. The endless song of disappointment. Think of the practice as a practice of shouldlessness, a practice of blamelessness. There's a taste of freedom in letting go of the heroic efforts to control all things and to align ourselves actually with the unpredictability, the existential uncertainty of this life. So much effort in our life goes into providing the sort of illusory stability so that we won't be surprised. How much of our deepening as a human being relies upon our willingness to be surprised, our willingness to not always know, not always be able to control. The teaching in the Satipatthana goes on, it says, experiencing the whole body of the breath, diving deeply into the breath. The Satipatthana Sutta pretty much features the freedom of non-identification. To see the breath as the breath, the body as the body, not as me, not as mine. To dive deeply, to really dive deeply into the process of the body breathing moment to moment is to dive deeply into this moment, but it is essentially to let go of the idea of the breather. It's the idea of the breather that ties us into knots. It is not the breath of itself. It's just a small but perhaps a very significant glimpse of the freedom that is found, not only in being not identified with the breather, but also not being identified with the doer, the thinker, the achiever, the experiencer, the winner, the loser, and perhaps even more deeply, not being so identified with the sufferer. As the identification lessens, you do begin to notice that the formations of agitation and anxiety lessen with it. Because the degree of anxiety and agitation in our life is completely level with the degree of identification. I would really encourage you to check that out in your own experience and to see if that is true for you. The degree in which the identification begins to fall away is the degree to which the formations begin to calm. That calm is reflected in our breath and our body, and it's one of the most precious gifts we can offer to ourselves. But I would say that this is not an easy path. It is not always linear. It is not always predictable. How many moments do we come back to our breathing in a single sitting? How many moments do we come back to our footfall in a single walking? And yet every time we do that, there is a reclaiming of that ground of confidence. There's a reclaiming of that ground of integration. And there is a reclaiming of that capacity to relinquish the identification. I really love the poem Lost, and many of you will be familiar with. But it's so kind of articulates this sense of finding that ground. Stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it like a powerful stranger. Must ask permission to know it and be known. The forest breathes. Listen, it answers. I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again, saying here. No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a bush does is lost on you, you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you. I think this is something quite similar to our practice. We create the space, we make room for calm to find itself, for joy to find us, for contentment to find us. But first we learn to stand still. Now, that primary foundation of establishing that, or beginning to get a sense of that taste of freedom, of non-identification within the breathing, is expanded in the Satipatthana Sutta to contemplate the body as the body. Whether sitting or standing or walking or lying down, to contemplate the body internally, to contemplate the body externally. There is a personal story to the life of our body. There is a universal story to the life of all bodies. Why so much emphasis? Because just as we can struggle and suffer so much within the body, so too are we asked to find the end of suffering within the body. How do we suffer within the body? Basically through fear. We fear mortality. We fear aging. We fear pain. We fear change. Is anyone here exempt from all of this? We can hold the illusion we are. There was Stephen Levine once saying he was doing a workshop on death and dying, and he began by asking anyone to raise their hand who was going to die. Took a long time for anybody to put their hand up. This is how we suffer within the body. It's a simple truth. There is much that is lovely within the body. The body is such a powerful vehicle for communicating, articulating love and care and compassion, for appreciation, for sensitivity. And there's a lot that's difficult. But the difficulty is compounded, isn't it? When identification arises, when I am my body is me. And all that happens in my body happens to me. The Satipatthana is so simple and yet so profound in its invitation that this is the layer that can be relinquished. To know the body as the body. To know the body like all that is born, is held within the rhythms of life. Of arising and passing, of birth and death, of change, uncertainty. To explore the body and the possibility of not clinging, not identifying with the body as self. In a way, this liberates the body. In a way, it liberates the body from the extra layers of suffering, of aversion and craving. The Buddha once said that to practice mindfulness within the body is to find a way to partake of the deathless. Because it is the identification with the body that actually really is the prison. It is the anguish. It is the struggle. But it's not easy, is it, to contemplate the body as the body? I mean, it seems such a simple instruction, you know, and we contemplate the body throughout our lives, don't we? Yeah. Every time you look in the mirror, here I am. But we often contemplate the body actually through the eyes of craving, or through the eyes of aversion, or through the eyes of identification. Beautiful, not beautiful, getting older, gray, all the rest of it, doing terrific. You know, we can also add that piece. You know, a few years ago when I started my career as a gym fanatic, I won a rowing competition for my age group, it has to be said. But I was so horrified, I was mortified when they put my name on the gym door. I mean, part of me was like totally delighted to win this rowing competition. You know, and that was the part, oh yeah, fantastic, you know, really doing amazingly well. And then and it's so amazing to see that absolute delight turn to this mortification, you know, which was the same part of identification, you know, that now people are going to expect me to win this competition every time, you know, and you know, now I've got this obligation to be the best rower in my age group in the gym. But we're learning to actually contemplate the body through different eyes, through the eyes of insight, through the eyes of compassion, through the eyes of kindness and care, rather than through the eyes of identification. And this brings considerably more grace into our lives. But it is also a powerful lesson in how we learn to relate to all bodies. Remember the instruction, contemplate the body internally, contemplate the body externally. We identify not only inwardly, we fear not only inwardly, but of course we fear the deaths and the changes and the illnesses and the pains of those that we care for. And it disables our capacity to care fully. We taste the freedom in the foundation of the body. Like the body, this body has a potential to be a vehicle for so much clinging and aversion and craving, but also as a vehicle for so much compassion and love and kindness. The instruction goes on in the Satipatthana to contemplate feeling as feeling. Contemplate feeling as feeling. It's not a complex instruction because it's not about the world of emotion. It is about the world of kind of core feelings that are part of every sensory impression and every perception. The pleasant sounds, the unpleasant sounds, the pleasant sights, the unpleasant, the pleasant sensations, the unpleasant, the pleasant thoughts, the unpleasant. It is that almost that pre-verbal impression that takes a remarkable amount of mindfulness to actually register. Some people ask, how come feeling occupies its own foundation of mindfulness? After all, pleasant, unpleasant, that in between doesn't seem like such a big deal, does it? But certainly in Buddhist psychology, actually, and in contemporary psychology, there's a very deep recognition about how the way in which feeling, that primary imprint, is the basic building block for our world construction. It happens so fast, the unpleasant sound, and we're already contracting and closing down. The pleasant sound, and we're already on high alert for more. The unpleasant memory, even before it's even hardly recognized, and we're already abandoning. The pleasant sensation, and we're already moving into craving. What is very clear is the way, in terms of world construction, that for these primary feeling terms have almost a hotline to underlying patterns and constructions. So the pleasant immediately gets, you know, kind of wired into that pattern of craving and wanting more and keeping and maintaining. The unpleasant almost gets automatically established within the world of aversion and resistance and pushing away and getting rid of. And that which is neither particularly pleasant or unpleasant, we just fall asleep. You know, we just check out. We just say nothing's happening, you know. Life is flat. And then, of course, the word boredom, the terrible word boredom comes to visit us. This actually, you know, governs our life. It's often said, in Buddhist psychology, it says, feeling, vedana is the word in Pali, rules consciousness. The vedana rules consciousness. simply because of the automatic reactivity that gets associated with the feeling tones that are outside of our control, by the way, often. The Vedana rules consciousness because we see those continuums, that the kind of flight into patterns that are also behavioral. If you noticed it, I mean, it must become obvious, you know. I have a slightly unpleasant sensation of being chilly. I've got my shawl, you know, out of here, you know, and checking never coming here again, you know, it's too cold, it's arctic, you know. Sun shines on my face, I'm not going to that city, I'm going to hang out here in the sun. It's all so automatic. It feels so automatic, isn't it? And so much of mindfulness practice is coming out of that automatic mode, which is the impulsive mode, into the intentional mode. You know, maybe we can receive the pleasant with appreciation and gratitude and thankfulness without having to hold it as mine. You know, maybe the unpleasant, and it certainly will, come to visit us in this life, and maybe it can be met with mindfulness and compassion. Maybe it doesn't have to be surrounded by fear and by anxiety, which also makes it mine. Maybe we don't have to live in such a way where our inner aliveness is constantly dependent upon pursuing more and more Vedana to feeling tones in order to startle us into some kind of wakefulness. Maybe there's another kind of inwardly generated wakefulness which can receive this whole spectrum of life's differences and variations without being governed. Without being governed. This path really invites us to imagine a life where we are not governed by craving, by aversion, by fear, by anxiety, a heart of boundless inner sufficiency, a heart of boundless inner capacity. This is where actually those tendencies towards abandonment really come to an end. And we're encouraged to find that taste of freedom within our own minds and hearts. It's recognizing mind is process. Heart is process. That this mind exists in a state of potentiality. That our capacity for joy lives side by side with our capacity for depression. That our capacity for restlessness lives side by side with our capacity for profound calmness. That our capacity for dullness lives alongside our capacity for remarkable wakefulness. And what does it mean for us to actually know that capacity, that potentiality, is not an accident, that this is something that is genuinely cultivated, that it is brought into being. Many of you will know that the word in the original word in Pali for meditation is bhavana. Meditation came along much later, and I'm personally very suspicious of the word, because it's almost like, I'm going to meditate. You know, what does that mean? I'm going to sit. Isn't it a completely different question to ask ourselves, what it is that is being cultivated in this moment? What is it that is being brought into being in this moment? And how much that is a kind of gesture of confidence and a statement of capacity? And when the Buddha speaks of the liberated mind, and I think it's very useful to explore that landscape of what is meant by that. And he speaks about the mind and the heart that is luminous, that is radiant, that is bright, that is imbued with understanding and compassion, that is liberated from contractedness, dullness, distortion, and liberated to reflect, liberated to contemplate, liberated to articulate, to be creative. But that begins with being mindful of the mind. Mindful of the mind. This is a very useful contemplation. Again, when we think of mind, we tend to go for capital letters, don't we? My mind. Usually in a rather disparaging tone. Mind is process. Endlessly being shaped by different conditions, different qualities, moment to moment. There is no mind as such. There is the process of minding. And this is what we're learning to take care of, the minding of the moment. Seeing what leads to staticness. Actually, whenever we say the phrase, my mind, it should be a little alarm bell that there's some identification going on. My mind is like this. It's almost like process has been interrupted by identification. That is the nature of identification. It interrupts process. It interrupts something unfolding and changing. The very nature of identification is almost to freeze something in place. Whether I freeze you in place through my view of you, whether I freeze myself in place through my view of myself, or whether I freeze the mind in place through identification with a particular thought, a particular state, a particular memory. This is the nature of identification, is to move things from process into nouns. To move things from process into state. There is a tremendous freedom in actually developing sufficient mindfulness to actually begin to allow process to unfold. That is the mind in which nothing really sticks. That is the mind that the Buddha describes as a mind of freedom. And when he tastes it, when the Buddha describes this taste of freedom within the collected mind, he likens it actually to the sudden liberation from being in debt. He likens that liberated mind to stepping into the shade, the coolness of the shade of a tree on a scorching day. He likens it to crossing a desert safely to a place of refuge. And again, that not clinging is not a vacant mind. But the liberated mind is actually the mind that is actually imbued with everything that we long for in this life. In terms of patience, calmness, kindness, empathy, generosity. Cultivate the tastes. Because the tastes build on themselves. Okay, thank you.